How do we see? Opening our eyes, looking outward from the eye sockets in our heads, we perceive, unless perhaps we are being subjected to an experiment by a psychologist or are about to faint away, we usually perceive objects in a world: chairs, the floor, walls, windows, trees, houses, automobiles, dogs, cats, birds, people. Each object situated at any moment in some place in an environment that spreads out from here, that is, from wherever we happen at the moment to be. Visual perception, almost always, is of persisting, stable, space-occupying things or objects, things not only extended and shaped in length and width, but modeled in depth, and located with respect to certain background surfaces, like the floor or walls of the room, or the terrain outside, or the surface of the bay. The solid objects look solid, the square objects look square, the horizontal surfaces look horizontal, and a person who approaches me from 100 feet away does not grow to 10 times his previous size. The visual world, with its stable, meaningful objects, remains patiently there for my inspection in all its meaningful knownness and unknownness. It is all so familiar. And yet the performance of seeing, all of you surely know, is a complex affair. It depends on certain organs or instruments and conditions. In order for anyone to see, there must be light to see by, the eyes must be open and must focus and point properly, certain sensitive cells of the retina of the eye must react to light in certain ways, nerve fibrils must transmit impulses to certain nerve ganglia, and these must transmit impulses on to what has been called the enchanted loom, the brain. Let any one of these conditions not be fulfilled, and seeing will not occur. Yet seeing does not feel like a complex physical process. Rather, it feels as if things are simply there when we open our eyes. The fact that, on the basis of physiological processes occurring in my head, I should see a world out there, a world that I believe I share with you, though at any moment I acknowledge, and I believe you acknowledge, that we are seeing it under different perspectives. This, when I start to reflect on it, seems little short of miracle. Please do not expect me to explain away that miracle tonight. The world that I perceive before me, into which I enter perforce, and where I meet you on a basis of essential equality, that perceived world I take to be a primary datum. Its existence seems to me to be presupposed in one way or another in whatever I may say on any subject whatsoever, even when, seeking to philosophize, I pretend or imagine that it is not so. My language, and hence my thought, are deeply rooted in the human experience of the humanly perceived world. My seeing and my knowing seem to be from within that world. True enough, I can be persuaded that the humanly perceived world is not the world simply. It differs from a cat's world or a rabbit's world, painted only in shades of gray. It differs from the world of an arthropod, a bee, say, with its compound, movement-sensitive eyes. The human eye, we are told, responds only to a narrow band in the spectrum of radiation frequencies. Does this mean that our seeing, and hence our knowing, are fundamentally perspectival and partial? Is there some act of prestidigitation or levitation whereby I can gain a perspective on my seeing and my knowing as though from outside my world? Such questions were raised in antiquity. One is reminded, for instance, of Protagoras' assertion that each thing is as it appears to him who perceives it. Protagoras is identifying perception with what is. He is attempting thereby to surmount the paradox presented by earlier cosmologists, for instance, the atomists, who on the one hand insisted on a sharp disjunction between appearance and reality, between what appears and what is, while on the other claiming sensation or perception as the basis of their theories. Protagoras proposes, in contrast, that there are no abiding elements underlying the world, but that the world consists of motions. Such motions, encountering one another, produce both the thing perceived and the perception. Neither the perception nor the thing perceived exists of itself, but only each for and with the other. Where nothing is perceived, nothing exists, and conversely, whatever is perceived exists. Thus, Protagoras concludes, my perception is true for me, since its object at any moment is what is there for me, and I am a judge of what is for me, that it is, and of what is not, that it is not. Protagoras is asserting that it is impossible to err. The implication, unfortunately, is that the notion of truth is empty, no statement being controvertible. Protagoras attempts to encapsulate his doctrine in the famous formula, man is the measure of all things. But it seems to be human beings in the plural that he is referring to, and they disagree. Moreover, it is not clear why other creatures, say cats or crustaceans, should not be the measure of all things. The universality of the Protagorean thesis runs counter to its content. Issues of this kind were being talked about and argued over at the time modern science came to be. Skepticism with respect to the possibility of true knowledge arose out of the religious conflicts of the 16th century, out of the discovery and exploration of the New World, which revealed the existence of plants, animals, and peoples that Aristotle did not know, out of certain challenges to traditional medicine and astronomy posed by Paracelsus and Copernicus. The men most notably responsible for setting modern science on its way, Kepler, Galileo, Descartes, were to make a new beginning, to lay new foundations for human knowledge. The attempt at a new beginning becomes most radical and far-reaching in Descartes. It is with the theory of visual perception as it relates to the emergence of Cartesian thought that I'm going to be concerned tonight. My account will begin with the development of Kepler's theory of the eye as an optical instrument, including his discovery in 1603 of the formation of the retinal image. I shall go into some detail as to how this discovery came about, as an example of learning and discovery that can provide us with certain terms that will be useful later on. Then I shall turn to the Cartesian interpretation of the Keplerian result. For Descartes, Kepler's theory of the optics of the eye becomes an inspiration and vindication of Cartesian physics and philosophy. In the final portion of the lecture, I shall undertake a brief critique of the Cartesian interpretation. Prior to the publication of Kepler's theory, from the 13th through the 16th centuries, the generally accepted theory of vision in the European universities was that due to an Arab optician of the 11th century. The Europeans called him Alhazen. Without describing this theory in much detail, let me say first that following Galen, the Greek physician and anatomist, Alhazen supposed the sensitive organ of the eye to be the crystalline humor, what we now call the lens. This crystalline humor was supposed to be right in the center of the eye, a notion not challenged till the second half of the 16th century. The ciliary muscles and ligaments connecting the lens to the coatings of the eye were thought by Galen to be nerves, and this was a reason for supposing the crystalline humor to be the sensitive element. Secondly, Alhazen assumed that not all the light rays entering the eye were effectual in producing vision, but only those rays which started from the surface of the object, crossed the surface of the eye perpendicularly, and came to an apex in the center of the crystalline humor, thus forming a pyramid. If more rays were to take part in the production of vision, Al Hazen thought, there is focus of a pencil of rays within the eye, nor did anyone before Kepler. It was Kepler who introduced these terms, pencil and focus, into optics. Thirdly, as to what the soul senses, Al Hazen essentially followed the Aristotelian account. The soul senses the sensible form of the thing seen without its matter. This is not a copy theory. No images are involved. It is an identity theory. To perceive the sensible form of a thing is to perceive the object as it is. The soul is passive. It receives the sensible form. What is received in the eye must travel along the optic nerve to the brain, according to Al Hazen, in order for sensation to be completed. But already in the eye, the motion of light somehow has brought about a sensation that is the reception of the sensible form. How did Kepler come to break with this optical tradition of the universities? Certain anatomical discoveries played a role. In the latter half of the 16th century, it was discovered that the crystalline humor was far forward in the eye, and that the cutting of the ciliary processes does not prevent vision. But at a crucial point, I believe, Kepler was dependent here on a tradition that was not an academic one, the tradition of perspectiva pingendi. In this term, perspectiva does not mean what we mean by perspective, but rather the same thing as optics, the science of vision. Thus, the standard textbook of optics in the universities for 300 years up to Kepler's time was Johannes Peckham's Perspectiva Communis, the common perspective. Perspectiva Pingendi, on the other hand, was the optics of painting, the science that forms the basis of the art of drawing in perspective, to use the term in the sense that it has now come to have. Perspectiva Pingendi was sometimes referred to as a secret art, its rules being passed orally from one painter or draftsman to another in the 15th century. But Kepler was able to read about it in a book by Albrecht Dürer, published in 1538, and entitled Instruction in Mensuration. I shall be pursuing this connection shortly. The starting point of the train of thought that led Kepler into an intensive study of optics was an astronomical anomaly. In April of 1598, Tycho Brahe, the famous observational astronomer, wrote to the professor of mathematics at Tübingen to report his observation of a solar eclipse earlier that year. What was especially remarkable was the apparent size of the moon when eclipsing the sun. Truly, Tycho wrote, it must be recognized that the moon, when it is on the ecliptic and when it is new, that means that it's going to eclipse the sun, does not appear to be the size which it is at other times at full moon, even though it is then at the same distance from the Earth. But it is, as it were, constricted by about one part in five from certain causes to be disclosed elsewhere. The causes were to be disclosed elsewhere, but not by Tycho, who was totally ignorant of what they were. The only thing he did conclude for sure was that there could never be a complete eclipse of the sun, and in this he was wrong. Kepler read of the anomaly in a letter from his former teacher at Tübingen in July. He was at this time 27 years old and employed as a rather poor school teacher, in both senses, in the Duchy of Styria in Lower Austria. The report of a 20% shrinkage of the moon during solar eclipses perplexed and intrigued him. He imagined various hypotheses to explain the appearance. One of them, for instance, was that the moon had a transparent atmosphere. He also studied medieval books on the perspectiva of the schools, seeking an optical explanation. On July 10th, 1600, there occurred another eclipse of the sun, and Kepler observed and measured it with special apparatus set up in the marketplace of Graz in Styria. By the end of the month, he had correctly resolved the Tychonic paradox in terms of optics, as he reported a little later to his former teacher. I have been fully occupied in calculating and observing the solar eclipse. While I was involved in preparing the special instrument, setting up the boards under the sky, some fellow took the opportunity to observe another shadow, and it produced not an eclipse of the sun, but of my purse, costing me 30 gulden. A costly eclipse, by God, but from it I have deduced the explanation why the moon shows so small a diameter on the ecliptic at new moon. And so in what was left of July, I have written a paralipomena to the second book of the Optics of Vitello. Now, Vitello's Optics had been written about AD 1270 in northern Italy and was based largely on the Optics of Alhazen. Paralipomena means things omitted. When Kepler's book on optics finally appeared in 1604, it had swollen from a brief explanation of Tycho's paradox into a 450-page treatise, The Foundation of Modern Optics, the Science Not of Vision, but of Light. But it still carried the old title, Things Omitted by Vitello. Now, what was Tycho's paradox, really? And how did Kepler resolve it? You must first understand that in Tycho's time, eclipses were being observed by means of the camera obscura, a dark room with a single small hole in the wall through which the rays of the sun are admitted. The first slide, please. The idea of using the camera for quantitative astronomy goes back at least to the 13th century, but its common use for the measuring of eclipses dates from the 1540s. The slide is from a book on astronomical measurements published in 1545. It shows a double cone of imagined light rays passing through the tiny aperture in the wall, and it clearly depicts the inversion of the solar crescent on the wall. Let me incidentally call your attention to the fact that the depiction is in focused or linear perspective. That is, the lines that we take to be receding perpendicularly from the plane of the drawing are so oriented as to intersect at a point called the vanishing point. Kepler's eclipse measuring instrument in 1600 was not an obscure room, but an obscure tent. Next slide, please. It consisted, like the camera, of a small aperture and a screen for receiving the image. The beam carrying the screen could be adjusted so that the receiving screen would be perpendicular to the rays of the sun. When an observation was in progress, the whole apparatus, including Kepler himself, not shown here, was covered by a black cloth. Now, Tycho's shrunken moon is actually a shrunken shadow. To understand the shrinking, we have to understand how a luminous object forms an image behind an aperture that is not a point, but has a finite size. In the camera obscura, it won't do to use a very tiny aperture, because then the image is feeble, and its boundaries become indistinct. But let the aperture be the size of a pea, as Kepler did, and the size of the image will be affected in the way shown by the next slide, please. On the left, imagine a luminous triangle. The rays of light emerging from any given point of the triangle and passing through the round aperture in the middle form a cone. On the right, you can see that the illuminated portion of the screen will not be triangular, but will be of such a shape as one obtains from a triangle by augmenting it on all sides by a border of uniform width. That is, it will be a three-sided figure with rounded corners. The width of the border depends on the distance of the object and on the distance and size of the aperture. If the luminous object is distant enough so that the rays of light coming from any point of it and passing through the aperture are very nearly parallel, then very nearly the width of the border will be half the diameter of the aperture. Actually, there are two ways of conceiving the formation of the image. Next slide, please. One can think of the whole luminous object as being projected through each point of the aperture to yield innumerable overlapping images on the screen. This was the standard medieval way of analyzing the rays coming from an object, that is, to think of them as forming a pyramid with base on the object, apex in the eye, or in the case here, in the aperture of the camera. The other way of analyzing the image is the one Kepler used. Next slide, please. Here, one considers all the rays emerging from each point of the object. To the cone of rays emerging from a given point and passing through a round aperture, Kepler gave the name pencil, which in his day meant painter's brush or pencil. The medieval analysis takes the object as its starting point. Kepler's analysis takes the point source of light rays as its starting point. Although the pencils and the pyramids encompass exactly the same rays, the analysis in terms of pencils is probably the more helpful in letting us see what the shape of the image will be. In the case of the luminous crescent of the partially eclipsed sun, for instance, it will be a crescent with rounded horns. The quantitative analysis of Tycho's paradoxical phenomenon is now easy. Next slide, please. The crescent image of the sun has been augmented on all sides by a border of width equal to the radius of the aperture, while the shadow of the moon has been diminished by a border of the same width. This Keplerian solution to the Tychonic paradox happens to have been very important in the history of 17th century astronomy, but it is so straightforward that I do not anticipate your being moved to rapture over it. It simply makes a rigorous application of the rectilinear propagation of light to the camera obscura. Had this never been done before? It had, but the correct solution was unknown in Europe before Kepler. The medieval treatises discussed a special form of the problem, namely, why is it that behind an angular aperture, when the screen is sufficiently distant, the image cast by the sun is round? The most common solution among the medieval opticians was to say that light has a tendency to round itself out, that it contains an active power which brings this about. Light, it was said, was the bearer of all creative and causal action and thus had this power. Kepler read these medieval discussions. He was even attracted to the Neoplatonic theory of light that they contained. He has left us a very explicit account of the way in which he came to reject the notion that light could round itself out in violation of rectilinear propagation. I quote, "A certain light drove me out of the shadows of Peckham several years ago." Peckham is the author of the Perspectiva Communis. "For, since I could not comprehend the obscure sense of the words from the diagram on the page, I had recourse to a personal observation in three dimensions. I placed a book on high to take the place of the shining body. Between it and the floor, I set a tablet having a many-cornered aperture. Next, a thread was sent down from one corner of the book through the aperture and onto the floor. It fell on the floor in such a way that it grazed the edges of the aperture. I traced the path produced and by this method created a figure on the floor similar to the aperture." He goes on to describe then the tracing of the aperture from each salient point of the book. I go on, "And so it becomes possible for solving the problem to bring in circularity, not of the rays of light, but of the sun itself. Not because the circle is the most perfect figure, but because it is the figure of the shining body." So it is a thread that leads Kepler out of his perplexity and to the vindication of rectilinear propagation of light and of the invariant size of the moon. It may seem preposterous to ask where the idea of using the thread came from, but I have a guess. It has to do with perspectiva pingenti. What is perspectiva pingenti, focused or linear perspective, Renaissance perspective, as it is variously called? The rules of linear or focus perspective seem to have been worked out, at least in part, in ancient times, apparently in connection with the painting of scenery for dramas. It was the Greeks who first entered upon the path of trying to produce on a flat surface the illusion of three-dimensional figures and scenes. In the painting of other ancient peoples, before they came under Greek influence, there is almost no evidence of an interest in such illusion. The difference seems to be connected with the Greek interest in fiction, epic and drama freed from ritualistic constraints. So on countless Greek vases and mixing bowls, one finds painted scenes in which something wicked and interesting is going on. Next slide, please. This slide shows a scene from the ambush of Dolon in the Iliad. The mastery of techniques for producing the three-dimensional illusion was progressive. Foreshortening, consistent handling of light and shade, the increasing mistiness with distance, the various tricks of illusionist painting were mastered over a period of some centuries. Ancient authors who write of the history of painting, like Pliny and Quintilian, record it as a series of triumphs in the production of progressively more persuasive illusions. In the final stages of the Greek progress, the paintings were painted not on vases, which tend to be preserved, but on walls, which tend to crumble. However, the accident of the eruption of Vesuvius in AD 79 has preserved for us some of these paintings in the ruins of Pompeii and Herculaneum. Such signatures as one finds on the paintings are Greek. Next slide, please. A large part of the art lay in learning to rely on the imagination of the beholder, which is very obliging and assures us that this young woman is a creature of grace and beauty. We can never know whether it is good luck or bad that she can never turn around. Next slide, please. Here is an imaginary sacred landscape in which spatial recession is suggested by an adroit handling of light and linear perspective. Also present is what Leonardo would call aerial perspective, the increasing indistinctness as the scene recedes into the distance. Next slide, please. But linear perspective emerges most clearly in wall decorations from about the middle of the first century BC that represent theater sets. I'm sorry that's so dark. Apparently a common form of wall decoration for homes in the region around Pompeii and Herculaneum. Here the lines of the colonnaded court seen, or should be able to be seen, above the facade wall recede to a single vanishing point, as they should because of their parallelism. That a mathematical theory of linear perspective had been worked out in antiquity is suggested by certain passages in the book on architecture written by Vitruvius about 25 BC. He describes scenography as the sketching of the front and of the retreating sides of buildings and the correspondence of all lines to a fixed center. It is necessary, he says, that a fixed center being established, the lines correspond by natural law to the sight of the eyes and the extension of the rays, so that certain images may render the appearance of buildings in the painting of stages, and things which are drawn upon certain surfaces may seem in one case to be receding and in another to be projecting. During medieval times, the interest in visual illusion faded to be revived in the late 13th and 14th century by the artists that Dante praises, Cimabue and Giotto. But it was not till the early 15th century that a mathematical theory of perspective reappeared. It was the work of Brunelleschi, the architect of the great dome of the cathedral in Florence, and a reader of Vitruvius. Next slide, please. Brunelleschi's procedure, illustrated in this slide for a rectangular solid, started from the architectural ground plan and elevation. Lines were drawn from every salient point of these plans to the position of the eye as projected onto the same plane. The intersection of these connecting lines with the picture plane gave the dimensions to use in the perspective construction. Brunelleschi's procedure came to be called the costruzione legittima, the legitimate construction. Other less time-consuming procedures for producing a similar result were later introduced. Next slide, please. The first treatise on painter's perspective was written by Leon Battista Alberti in 1435. And Alberti makes much of the sottilissimo velo, the most subtle veil, shown here in a somewhat uncomfortable representation by Dürer. It is a grid of threads through which the object to be drawn is looked at from a fixed point. It has sometimes been asserted that a curvilinear system of perspective would be more correct than the linear perspective used in the Renaissance. Panofsky, the late historian of art, endorsed this notion, claiming that Renaissance perspective was a mere convention comparable to the conventions of versification in poetry. This is surely wrong. Linear perspective is based on certain constraining assumptions, namely that only one eye is used and that the head is kept immobile. But given these assumptions, it does what the Renaissance artists thought it did. It sends to the eye the same pattern of lines and points as the object itself would. It has nothing to do with the shape of the retina or with neurophysiology or psychology. It is simply a matter of rectilinear light rays and projective geometry. Next slide, please. The rectilinear light ray is materialized in the procedure represented in this picture by Durer. A perspective picture of a lute is being constructed. A needle or nail having a large eye has been fastened into the right-hand wall. A heavy thread is led through the needle, a weight being attached to the lower end of the thread. Between the needle and the lute, a frame is set up which has a little door hinged to it that is free to move in and out of the plane of the frame. Crossing the rectangular space enclosed by the frame are two other threads which the picture does not clearly show. They are free to be moved across the plane of the frame. They intersect at right angles and so define a point of the plane. The free end of the weighted thread is led through the plane of the frame and held on a point of the lute by the man at your left. The threads crossing in the frame are moved till their intersection coincides with the point at which the weighted thread cuts through the plane. The weighted thread is then taken away, the little door bearing the paper is shut, and a mark is made on the paper where the movable threads intersect. The process must be repeated for other points of the object, as many as the draftsman feels are necessary for its proper portrayal. The finished picture will show the lute as it would be seen by a single eye situated at the position of the needle in the right-hand wall. It was a standard problem for Renaissance artists to avoid the undesirably sharp foreshortening that results when the beholder's eye is only an arm's length from the plane of the picture. Durer's apparatus solves this problem mechanically. It is only a conjecture, of course, to propose that Kepler's thread was the direct offspring of Durer's thread. But Kepler's choice of the pencil of light as the element of his analysis of the camera obscura surely stems from perspectiva pingendi, the projective geometry of light rays, rather than the perspectiva communis of the schools, according to which the light rays had the capacity to round themselves out. But the theory of the camera obscura, once formulated, poses for Kepler the problem of the optics of the eye. This problem is discussed in the fifth chapter of the Paralipomena, which bears the title On the Mode of Vision. The eye evidently resembles a camera obscura. The substances within are transparent, and the external coverings exclude light except where the pupil or aperture is. But the eye could not be a camera obscura because, as Kepler had learned, the larger the relative size of the aperture, the fuzzier the image, and the pupil of the eye was large enough to produce a total confusion of overlapping images at the back of the eye. Kepler turned to the accounts of the anatomists. All but one held to the standard view according to which the crystalline humor was the sensitive element. A certain Felix Plater, however, had learned that what were supposed to be the nerves to the crystalline humor could be cut without loss of vision, and further, that the crystalline humor was far forward in the eye. To him, the eye looked like a camera obscura with a magnifying glass in front. Such instruments had been constructed in the late 16th century. It was left to Kepler to explain how a lens forms an image. Convex lenses had been in use as burning and magnifying glasses for centuries. Eyeglasses had been in use since the 13th century. But Kepler was the first to account for their operation in terms of geometrical optics, the paths of light rays. He recognized that there could be a one-to-one correspondence between luminous points outside the eye and illuminated points on the retina, provided that the cornea and crystalline humor were understood to act as lenses which refract the diverging pencils of light from each bright point outside and bring each of them to convergence to illuminate a single point on the retina. With a globe of glass containing water, he constructed a model of the eye to show how it worked. He it was who first formulated the simple quantitative rules governing the distances and sizes of images formed by lenses. Next slide, please. He was the first to be able to give an account of farsightedness, nearsightedness, the function of eyeglasses in correcting these defects, and why, despite the finite size of the aperture, a sharp image can be formed. And he always describes the geometrical optics of the eye in terms that remind us of painting, painting the world outside on the retina of the eye. The image he calls a pictura, a picture, and he speaks of its production as a painting. And for the conical bundles of light rays that do the painting, he introduces the term pencil, meaning painter's brush. May I have the lights now? What about the upside-downness and left-for-right reversal of the retinal image? Kepler regards these as simply necessitated by the behavior of light. How, given the retinal image, vision then occurs, he does not offer to say. I quote, "I leave it to be disputed by natural philosophers how this picture is put together by the visual spirits that reside in the retina and nerves. The impression of this image on the visual spirits is not optical, but physical and wonderful, admirabilis." Kepler is saying that what happens in the retina and optic nerve and brain surpasses the powers of the mathematical optician. Not being reducible to mathematics, it seems to be, in Kepler's view, ultimately inexplicable, analogous to the mystery of creation. "Just as the eye was made to see colors," he writes, "and the ear to hear sounds, so the human mind was made to understand not whatever you please, but quantity. It is the characteristic of the human understanding, which seems to be such from the law of creation, that nothing can be known completely except quantities. And so it happens that the conclusions of mathematics are most certain and indubitable." End quote. Kepler's view of the world was profoundly affected by the theory of perspectiva pingendi. The theorists of perspectiva pingendi had resurrected the famous formula of Protagoras: man is the measure of all things. But they meant by it not the denial of the possibility of knowledge, but in a special way, the contrary. Seeing is perspectival, no doubt, but the perspective can be understood. Perspective measures space. Space is known through quantities. Quantities measure the permanent order of nature. At the center of every perspective system is man himself, who becomes the judge and standard for all comparisons. It is he, for instance, who apprehends and judges the beauty of things as consisting in harmonious proportions. That is a paraphrase from Alberti. Kepler shared these ideas. He viewed the whole cosmos as a divinely created three-dimensional work of art, an image of the divine Trinity, the structure of which we can determine from the perspectives we have of it. Man, created in the image of God, is the contemplative creature, the measuring creature, as Kepler repeatedly calls him. He is placed on the midmost planet so that by taking account of his changing position, he can carry out triangulations like a surveyor and determine the distances of the primary cosmic bodies and their harmonious arrangement. Travel, Kepler explains, is broadening. We view the cosmos always by means of a continually changing perspective, but by calculating for our own displacement, we can use that very perspective to determine the cosmic dimensions and harmonious order. And so doing, Kepler says, the soul, which is like a point, becoming contemplative, expands, as it were, into a circle. The sphere is reserved as the image for God himself. I turn now to Descartes. In a letter of 1638 to an acquaintance, Descartes acknowledges Kepler as his first master in optics. Descartes was not in the habit of admitting intellectual indebtedness. I do not know of another case in which he did so. But for Descartes, the Keplerian theory of the eye as an optical instrument was both an inspiration for and vindication of Cartesian physics and philosophy. With Descartes, optics displaces astronomy as the key science for the understanding of the world. The Keplerian theory of the eye as an optical instrument presents itself to Descartes as vanishing mystery from the eye. Following Kepler, it becomes possible to construct a model of the eye, complete in just about every detail, down to the image at the rear that one may catch on a translucent piece of parchment. Of course, we do not see the inverted, reversed perspectival images on our own retinas. For that, there would be needed an eye behind the eye, and there is no such eye. As to what happens in the optic nerve and brain, in order that vision may be completed, Kepler leaves this mystery as deep as he found it. The Keplerian theory of image formation means, for Descartes, that the traditional Aristotelian and scholastic theory of visual perception is wrong. Sensation is not the reception of the sensible form of a thing without its matter, because, in the first place, visual sensation is perspectival. At the beginning of the first book he completed for publication, a book entitled The World, Descartes wrote, "It is commonly believed that the ideas we have in our thoughts entirely resemble the objects from which they proceed. But I observe, on the contrary, several experiences that ought to make us doubt it." One of the experiences Descartes has in mind here is that of looking at pictures. He writes, "You can see that engravings, being made of nothing but a little ink placed here and there on the paper, represent to us forests, towns, men, and even battles and storms, even though, among an infinity of diverse qualities which they make us conceive in these objects, only in shape is there actually any resemblance. And even this resemblance is a very imperfect one, seeing that, on a completely flat surface, they represent to us bodies which are of different heights and distances, and even that, following the rules of perspective, circles are often better represented by ovals rather than by other circles, and squares by diamonds rather than by other squares, and so for all other shapes. So that often, in order to be more perfect as images and to represent an object better, they must not resemble it." End quotation. But Descartes' critique of the traditional account of perception goes deeper. According to Aristotle and the Schoolmen, things were very much what they appeared to be. The objects perceived were themselves colored. Heat and cold were what, in ordinary experience, we apprehend them as being. The qualities of objects were the specifications of the things that made each one of them to be what it was. But how can such perception occur? The traditional theory fails to explain how such resemblance or identity is physically achieved. The proponents of this theory cannot show us how sensations can be formed, I'm quoting Descartes, can be formed by these objects, received by the external sense organs, and transmitted by the nerves to the brain. Now, if the traditional assumption of resemblance between sensations and their objects is questionable or without warrant, then the traditional attempt to found the sciences by a stepwise advance from sense perception is also questionable or without warrant. In that case, how are the sciences to be founded? At the beginning of The World, Descartes proposes to construct a fable of a world feigned at pleasure. Matter in this feigned new world, Descartes proposes, should be something of which we cannot even pretend ignorance. This requirement is met by extension. For, I quote, "The idea of extension is so comprised in all other things which our imagination is able to form, that it is necessary for you to conceive it if you imagine anything whatsoever," end quote. Having seized upon this first principle, Descartes proceeds to frame in terms of it a fabulous account of the world and of man. All is to be accounted for in terms of matter, that is, figured or shaped extension, or space, in motion. Some features of this system can be deduced from the first principle, others must be constructed. The fabulous world that results is scientific in the sense that it involves only what can be clearly conceived. It thus embodies the rigor of mathematics. In this fable of a world, Descartes is able to provide a clear conception of the way sensations are formed by their objects, received by the external sense organs, and transmitted to the brain. First, I quote, All the external senses serve in a purely passive way, precisely in the manner in which wax receives shape from a seal. We have to think of the external shape of the sentient body as being really altered by the object precisely in the manner in which the shape of the surface of the wax is altered by the seal." End quote. This description applies not only to touch but also to sight, in which light, conceived as a pressure transmitted through a medium, plays the same role as a blind man's stick. Since with our two eyes we apprehend a single thing, with our two ears a single sound, with our two hands a single body when we are touching one, Descartes concludes that there must be a center in which the incoming stimuli are coordinated, the pineal gland. The whole process of vision Descartes now describes as follows. If we see some animal approach us, the light reflected from its body depicts two images of it, one in each of our eyes. The two images, by way of the optic nerves, form two others on the interior surface of the brain, which faces its cavities. From these, by way of the spirits or subtle fluids which fill these cavities, the images then radiate towards the small gland which the spirits encircle, and do so in such fashion that the movement which constitutes each point of one of the images tends towards the same point of the gland as does the movement constituting that point in the other image, which represents the same part of this animal. And in this way, the two brain images form but one image on the gland, which, acting immediately on the soul, causes it to see the shape of the animal. The Keplerian optics of the eye is thus interpreted as a mechanism for transmitting pressure, and this same mechanism is imagined as transmitting the patterned pressures onward from the retinas through the nerves to the brain, with final composition of a single image on the pineal gland, or sensus communis, or imagination, as Descartes calls it. The entire process up to the final apprehension by the soul of the image on the imagination, which is a body, is to be considered as consisting simply in the alteration of the spatial disposition of the parts of the body, not less, says Descartes, than the movements of a clock or other automaton. Some of you are familiar with the course of reflection whereby Descartes undertakes to justify and to lay unshakable foundations for this fabulous physics and physiology. According to this physics and physiology, we, that is, our souls, have immediate knowledge only of our ideas, including in this term, as Descartes does, sensations. Between our sensations on the one hand and that which provides the occasions for these sensations, namely the patterned pressures on the pineal gland, there opens an abyss. On one side is a qualityless world of matter in motion, on the other, worldless qualities in a consciousness that is out of the world, is extra mundane. Between world and self, Descartes attempts to construct a metaphysical bridge, taking for starting point his certainty that the isolated extra mundane self, even when it doubts everything it can, at least exists as the source of the doubt. He calls it a thinking thing. The central arch of the construction is theological. It finally enables Descartes to conclude that what can be clearly and distinctly conceived, provided it fits all the facts, is true. I shall not pursue this argument here tonight, my concern being rather with our perception of the visual world. Nor shall I deal further with the detailed mechanisms of perception in Descartes' fabulous physics. Action by pressure is not regarded today either as the mode of action of light or as that of the impulses in the nervous system. Among neurophysiologists today, there is considerable doubt that anything is to be gained by supposing that the neural processes copy or are isomorphic with the contents of consciousness, for example, are triangular in some way when one sees a triangle. Nevertheless, we still hear from neurophysiologists such statements as the following one by Lashley. All phenomena of behavior and of mind are ultimately describable in the concepts of the mathematical and physical sciences. The problem about how we are in or related to the world, so insistently posed by the Cartesian theory,
here recurs. Descartes' great achievement, it would appear, was to make the world safe for mathematical physics. But this achievement has left us outside, puzzled and questioning as to what we are. Once more, in the final section of this lecture, as in its beginning, I must ask you not to expect me either to do miracles or to explain them away. What I can attempt is to point in directions in which non-Cartesian perspectives open up. Let me begin by citing a certain number of results of recent studies of human visual perception. Next slide, please. To begin with, it is worth noting that the eye is in constant motion. It has a tremor with a frequency of between 30 and 80 cycles per second, and with an amplitude such as to shift a focused pencil of light from one retinal cell to the adjacent one. There are also wider flicks up to a third of a degree, coming at irregular intervals of up to 5 seconds, with slow drifts in between the flicks. The apparatus shown here is attached to a contact lens, and because it moves with the eye, it produces a stabilized retinal image. The effect of this is, first, within a few seconds, distorted vision, and shortly afterward, the complete breakdown of vision, in the sense that the viewer can no longer see anything at all, although a clear image is being focused on his retina. Vision is thus an active process and fails altogether when it ceases to be so. Next slide, please. Next, let me point out that the cues and clues to depth are multiple, more in fact than can be reviewed in brief compass. There is, to begin with, linear perspective, as in this slide. Note also here a size-distance relation, which reminds us how drastically the perceptual system transforms what is presented to it. As the little man walks into depth, he appears to increase in size, although the three images, in fact, take up the same size on the plane surface. This has to do with what is called perceptual constancy, of which I shall speak in a moment. Next slide, please. Gradients of texture immediately produce in us the sense of continuous surfaces stretching backward. Such surfaces generally provide the background against which we locate objects. Next slide, please. Then there is lighting. Light usually comes from one side, so that surfaces facing in different directions are differently illuminated. In late antiquity, these four-tone mosaic floors seem to have been popular, despite the treacherous appearance of being other than flat. Next slide, please. There is motion perspective. The differences in apparent relative velocity of different parts of the visual field as one moves one's head. The diagram here is for the more drastic case of an airplane pilot approaching the landing field. There are also binocular clues, impossible to illustrate on a single slide. There's the convergence of the two eyes, for example, and the accommodation of the lenses in each. By far the most important is binocular disparity, a fact which only came to be recognized after Charles Wheatstone's invention of the stereoscope in the 1830s. The retinal images received by the two eyes are not simply superposable, but are notably different, and this difference by itself can produce the visual perception of depth. Next slide. Scenes may be ambiguous. In particular, pictures being stationary and flat cannot provide motion perspective or the binocular clues to depth, and since the different three-dimensional shapes that can give the same projection on a plane surface are unlimited in number, it is evident that two-dimensional shapes can be ambiguous. The surprising thing is that we are so seldom misled or made aware of the ambiguity. The perceptual system quickly adopts the interpretation that satisfies the available clues. However, what you are looking at, a figure called the Necker cube, forces its ambiguity on our attention. No clue is offered as to which is the back face and which is the front. Both squares are of the same size. By an act of concentration on one square or the other, we can cause the perceptual shift from one to the other of the two possible interpretations of the figure as cube. We can even, by putting the mind to it, cause ourselves to see the figure as flat, though the spontaneous interpretation is a three-dimensional one. But suppose we gaze at the Necker cube steadily without any attempt to have one perception or the other. Then the perceptual shift occurs spontaneously. It is as if perception were a matter of suggesting and testing hypotheses. Of the two most satisfying ones, each is entertained in turn. But since neither is more successful than the other, neither is allowed to stay. Next slide, please. Some of you are familiar with the engravings of Escher, which make use of the ambiguities of two-dimensional representations to show wonderful and impossible places. This structure would solve the energy crisis. The water, after falling and turning the water wheel, conveniently flows on the level up to its starting point. Next slide, please. There are also impossible three-dimensional objects. Here's a photograph of one. Perception circles about, making sense of each corner and trying but failing to make sense of the whole as an actual object. So as not to keep you in suspense, I reveal the explanation, next slide please, which is that we've been viewing the object from a particular angle. Perceptual processes exhibit a characteristic called perceptual constancy, and this is another indication that perception is ceaselessly and actively oriented towards the interpretation of impressions in terms of objects in a world. A piece of coal in bright sunlight sends to our eyes maybe 100 times more light than a sheet of typing paper in the shade. Yet we interpret the former as a black piece of coal in the sunlight and the latter as a white piece of paper in the shade. The film color with which the retina is presented is analyzed in perception into a constant surface color belonging to the object on the one hand and the illumination to which the object is exposed on the other, the latter being drastically variable. Besides color constancy, there is shape constancy and size constancy. Size constancy, for instance, means that when an object doubles its distance from us so that the retinal image of it is halved in size, we perceive it not as shrinking, but as retaining its objective dimensions. To experience this, you can't do this right now, I realize, look at your two hands, one held at arm's length and the other at half the distance. They will probably look almost exactly the same size. But if the near hand is brought to overlap the far one, then they will look different in size in the way geometrical optics requires. Next slide, please. Certain well-known distortion illusions turn up ever and again in psychology textbooks. These, too, appear to be explicable in terms of the perceptual system's orientation towards interpreting patterns as objects in a world. In this slide, the upper horizontal bar appears longer, though it is of the same length as the lower one. The explanation that now seems likeliest is that the perceptual system is set to measure lengths appropriately to the normal world of three-dimensional objects as seen in linear perspective. The bar that would be more distant is scaled up in size in accordance with constancy scaling. That we do not see the inclined lines necessarily as parallel receding railroad tracks is due to the countermanding of the three-dimensional interpretation by textural features of the surface on which the figure appears. Next slide, please. The same kind of explanation can be made for the famous arrow illusion, in which two identical lengths appear different because of added fins. If the figures are constructed of wire, painted with luminous paint, and looked at in the dark, the left-hand one appears as an inside receding corner of a rectangular room, the right-hand one as the outside projecting corner of a rectangular block or building with sharp foreshortening. Even when, because of surface texture, three-dimensional depth is not perceived, it appears that constancy scaling goes to work on the basis of the clues that would normally indicate depth to produce the illusion. Zulus who live in round houses with round doors and plow their fields on curved lines do not experience most of these illusions and experience this particular one only slightly. Next slide, please. Finally, consider the famous distorted room constructed by the painter and psychologist Adalbert Ames some 25 years ago. The far wall slopes back to the left at an angle of 45 degrees, and the floor also slopes downward to the left. But linear perspective is used to make this oddly shaped room give, from a viewing point in the center of the front wall, the same retinal image as a normal rectangular room. The person in the far left-hand corner looks too small because the image is smaller than would be expected for the apparent distance of that part of the room. Evidently, our perceptual system has so accommodated itself to rectangular rooms that we accept it as obvious that it is the objects, here twin sisters, that are of odd sizes, rather than that the room is of an odd shape. The perceptual system has, as it were, made a bet, the wrong one, but then the experimenter has rigged the odds by choosing such an extremely odd shape for the room. Familiarity with the room gained by touching its walls with a long stick or a strong emotional relation to the person seen in the room will reduce the distorting effect of the room until it is finally seen for what it is, a distorted room in fact. May I have the lights for a few minutes, please? From all the foregoing, I conclude the following. Our perceptual system seems to behaves as if it were an instrument acting purposively with a view to identifying, placing, classifying, and judging objects in a world. What the senses initially receive are but the slenderest and most fleeting of clues, varied and varying patterns of energy. Objects, on the other hand, have indefinitely many features beyond the immediately sensed ones. They have pasts and futures. They have hidden aspects that manifest themselves under special conditions. They change and interact with one another. How is it possible, on the basis of the fleeting clues, to perceive the objects? Our perceptual system, faced with multiple fleeting clues, in effect makes a guess, launches into belief. Taking into account its previous beliefs, it hypothesizes that an object of such and such a kind is the invariant something of which the fleeting clues are perspectives. In brief, it is more like Kepler trying to resolve anomalies than like a Cartesian nervous system subject to pushes and pressures. Like our perceptual system, which to us is an instrument, we also are turned outward toward the world, toward the other, toward objects in a world. In our primary experience of the world, we face this other not as a dim ghost of something far removed, but in direct encounter. Our observing is not neutral from behind centimeters of bulletproof Polaroid. We are beset by what we see. We are affected, caught, seized in an egocentric position. Wind, heat waves, rain, and sleet obtrude themselves upon us. Things appear attractive and repulsive. What is presented has inherent distance, depth. The object is apprehended over there in its suchness and thusness, in its substantiality. The stimulus that comes to the sense organ does not so much cause the perception as trigger the actualizing of it. The stimulus delimits possibility here, but the perception remains intentional of an object, for there's a difference between sunburn and sight. The perceived object reveals itself insofar as it presents a surface. But while surfaces reveal, they also hide. Beyond what is revealed in any experience, there remains an indefinite other, unfathomed. But depth and distance are not merely visual. We are mobile, indeed self-moved. We can rise up from the ground and move in opposition to the other that is over against us in its otherness. We can be purposeful, adopting goals, moving up or down or along paths, going from a here to a there and from a now to a then, with changing perspectives. This is our primary mode of being. But our being is then a becoming in relation to an other, the other that is the world stretching out in depth before us in its manifold familiarity and strangeness. What I have said here could not consistently be said by Descartes. For him, the objects in the world, including his own body, are merely side by side and faceless, and consciousness has no intrinsic relation to them. But let us go to the nodal point, the indubitable point of doubt on which Descartes would found all. The objection to his formulation is that it is a human being, not a thinking thing, that doubts. My doubting presupposes my existence in the world. It presupposes my bondage to present place and time and viewpoint, and it presupposes the possibility of in some measure transcending the present limitations by the attainment of a more comprehensive view. It is in our human world, in which we encounter objects and one another through sensory experience, that knowledge is sought. Somehow that world must be such that such knowledge as we gain of it is possible. And what about the claim of the modern neurophysiologists who, and I quote one of them, takes completely for granted that behavior and neural functions are perfectly correlated, that one is completely caused by the other, end quote. The difficulty here, I believe, is that science itself is being denatured. All science, I do not see how it can be otherwise, rests on the possibility of a comparison between observed natural phenomena and constructed hypotheses. The comparing observer as observer is not included in the comparison. There has to be an observer who is not reduced simply to the observed. There has to be an experiencing organism in relation to a sensed environment. There have to be not merely stimuli affecting sensory receptors, but objects perceived in a world. In a few weeks, Mr. Spaeth, barring cosmic catastrophe, will be lecturing on the philosophy of Niels Bohr, one of the principal founders of modern quantum theory. What I've been saying agrees, I believe, with Bohr's interpretation of quantum theory. According to this, we cannot disregard the fact that natural science is formed by human beings. Natural science does not simply describe and explain nature. It is part of the interplay between nature and ourselves. It describes nature as exposed to our method of questioning. It has been the viewpoint of this lecture that human knowledge is always from a viewpoint, that it involves taking a stand within the world and so is inevitably perspectival. The Cartesian claim to have found a stand outside the world is, on this view, inauthentic, an odd byproduct of the imperialism of the geometrical imagination. Already in the 13th century, Henry of Ghent had characterized those in whom the geometrical imagination dominates over the cognitive faculty as suffering from an ailment. Whatever they think is a quantity, he writes, or is located in quantity, as is the case with the point. Therefore, such men are melancholy and become excellent mathematicians, but very bad metaphysicians, for they cannot extend their thought beyond location and space, which are the foundations of mathematics. Next slide, please. This very melancholy is pictured in Dürer's famous engraving of 1513 or 14, the Melancholia Prima. Here we see a winged, presumably celestial being, staring fixedly, evidently in despair. The scene is lit with an eerie light from the moon, a comet, and a lunar rainbow. Strewn about in bewildering disorder are the tools of geometrical and architectural construction. She, the celestial being, is afflicted, we surmise, with a sense of spiritual confinement, of insurmountable barriers separating her from a higher realm of thought. Dürer's conception of that higher realm is represented in another engraving which he made at the same time as the Melancholia and distributed with it as its appropriate counterpart. Next slide, please. This is Saint Jerome, comfortably seated in his warm, sunlit cell, which he shares with his contented animals, the monastery rules on pets being evidently more lenient than those at St. John's. He is absorbed in his theological work. Even the skull looks friendly. Jerome's incorporation into the strictly mathematical projection of our perspectival system, though it reveals his contentment, in no way reveals the secret of it, which may remain for some of us inaccessible. Is my acknowledgement of the perspectivity of human knowing then a skeptical conclusion? I think not. For all we know, the perspectivity revealed by the fact that we opine and that opinion is not knowledge may be the correct perspective. In any case, our perspectival viewing reveals a world into which we, along with others, are launched as essentially equal citizens. It is an experienced fact that we do not escape recognizing others as measures of ourselves. The claims of others call us out of our particularity into discourse, into the search for right opinion. This is a category unknown to skeptics, a human category revealing both our poverty and our power. Thank you.